loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Authorities in Iran have foiled what is being described as the biggest terrorist plot in the country's history. Who could have been behind the planned attacks, and how might regional and global rivalries come into play? Donald Trump has said that the U.S. should openly embrace a system of religious, racial, and ethnic profiling, citing Israel as a successful example of a country that uses such a system effectively. But is there already a system of racial and religious profiling in effect inside the United States? The referendum in Britain on whether to leave or remain inside the European Union is just 2 days away. Has the brutal murder of Labour MP by a far-right gunman last week boost the chances of Britain remaining in the EU? But first we turn to Iran. Authorities say they have disrupted the biggest terror plot ever to target Tehran, detaining several suspects they say were planning a series of bomb attacks across the capital city. Was it a plan by the so-called Islamic State, ISIS, Daesh, or could other actors be involved? We are joined by Wahid Azal. He is an independent political commentator based in Berlin. Welcome back, Wahid.
Thank you very much.
Iranian TV is identifying the plotters as Takfiri Wahhabis. What is Wahhabism? What is it? Help the broader global audience understand what they mean.
Well, Wahhabism is the puritanical ideology that stems from the thinking of a very extreme 14th, 15th century Sunni cleric by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah, who was appropriated by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in the 17th, 18th century and created this hyper-puritanical ideology that pretty much believes that all Muslims, other than those who adhere to their Wahhabi ideology, are essentially heretics. And because of an alliance with the Al Saud clan from the Najd region, central region of the Saudi Peninsula in the late 18th century, this has become the dominant political force in the region ever since. Early 20th century, especially after the First World War, the British helped this alliance of the Wahhabis with the Saud clan come to power in the peninsula, in opposition to all the other rivals.
The Saudi royal family, in other words, Wahhabism. But is this Saudi Arabia behind the terrorist plot that the government in Iran says they have uncovered and thwarted?
Oh, I mean, there's no question that there are Saudi hands. The Iranian authorities are being very sketchy on what particular group is responsible that they just foiled. You know, the insinuation is that it could possibly be ISIS, given where these suspects were apprehended. But we're also dealing with other terrorist organizations, Takfiri terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda affiliates, such as Jundullah and the Jund al-Adl, which are basically Baluchi and southern Iranian-based Al-Qaeda networks. So it could be any of these groups, but there are strong insinuations that it could be ISIS.
So the news was broken on Tasnim, which is close to the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. I mean, put it into a regional context, if you would. Does this signal or will this signal, do you believe, some sort of escalating tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Already, both countries are in a virtual sort of, well, a war is the wrong word, but a certain escalating conflict. And it plays out, of course, in Saudi Arabia, the recent executions of a large number of people, including Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr. All of that was seen as a provocation in Iran. Talk about that relationship right now.
Well, I mean, we are in a proxy war situation already, and I would even push it back further than this January with the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. If you recall, last year during Hajj, there was a massacre during the Mina, in the Maqam al-Mina, during the Hajj, where Saudi security forces, I mean, we still don't know what happened, went on a rampage and basically targeted Shiite pilgrims, mostly Iranian ones. and several former officials who were there amongst the pilgrims were martyred in that spectacle last year.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. The Hajj, this is all Muslims come to Mecca or try to at least once in their lifetime to make the Hajj. And so you have people from all nationalities gathering together, this gigantic mass of hundreds of thousands or millions of people doing that pilgrimage. And Saudi military forces went on a rampage.
That went on a complete rampage, yeah.
And was it against Shiites from Iran or from other places?
Well, there were other Shiites targeted, but the predominant number were Lebanese and Iranian Shiites. And we're talking about a number, several hundred people. I'm not exactly clear on the exact numbers off the top of my head, but we're talking quite a large number of people were martyred.
Well, if you talk about a proxy conflict, or certainly there's elements of a proxy conflict in terms of what's going on in Syria, the Syrian government led by Bashar al-Assad, of course, its military forces, the Syrian Arab Army, they are aligned with Hezbollah from Lebanon, the resistance forces in Lebanon, who are also predominantly Shiite. They also have a relationship, of course, internationally with Russia, which has come in on the side of the Assad government. But they also have a relationship, a tight strategic relationship and a long lasting relationship with Iran. And at the same time, you had Saudi Arabia arming a terrorist or ISIS or al-Qaeda forces. Is that continuing to play out in Syria?
Of course it's continuing to play out in Syria. But even within Lebanon itself, I don't know if you have followed, but the Saudis initiated this this scheme of putting sanctions on Lebanese financial institutions that were dealing with Hezbollah. And then immediately the United States picked up on it several months later. And so we are in a situation where the Lebanese financial system is being forced and blackmailed into not dealing with Hezbollah. You know, and this is a Lebanese organization elected to the Lebanese parliament, representing the Lebanese people, yet outside forces are basically leaning on the Lebanese government to sideline and marginalize the resistance organization. So this is coming from all directions. You can say Saudi Arabia. I mean, my thinking is that Saudi Arabia is a client of the Anglo-American Empire. So anything that the Saudis are doing is ultimately at the behest of Washington and London.
But let me just ask you I'm not devil's advocate, but just, you know, to challenge you a little bit on that, because historically that's undoubtedly been the case, that the Saudis have functioned as an extension of American power in the Gulf region, a proxy force. Ronald Reagan said famously in the 1980s, there won't be a revolution in Saudi Arabia. This was following the Iranian Revolution, meaning America was just going to make sure that the royal family stayed in power forever, as if they have that power. But that was the assertion. I hear you on that. But there have been, especially in recent years, signs of a growing tension or independence as the United States influence seems to have diminished in the region somewhat, or as the Obama administration has its own internal debates or differences over how to handle the issue in Syria. Is Saudi Arabia functioning just as a puppet of America at this point?
Well, it's a puppet. It's definitely a puppet of the oil companies, of the American oil companies. I mean, just remember that the majority stake of Aramco is still American held, and those interests exist right at this time. So, you know, if there are tensions, these are very surface ones, you know, as far as I'm concerned, really of no consequence. And if you look at the pattern of behavior, I mean, this whole issue with the sanctions on Lebanese financial institutions over Hezbollah began with Saudi Arabia. Now the Obama administration itself is running with it. So, I mean, no one can argue to me that, well, maybe they're moving apart and they're but where it counts on the ground on real geopolitical issues, these two are still aligned.
Saudi Arabia is not shy about intervening militarily in neighboring countries' affairs. The Bahraini government, which owes its existence really to the Saudi-led military intervention that crushed the democracy protests in 2011, it has just stripped the citizenship of Sheikh Isa Qassim, the highest-ranking Shiite religious leader in the country. What does that indicate about the Saudi role in Bahrain? And again, talk about, if you would, what the United States relationship is with the Bahrain royal family.
Well, the first thing to remind everybody is that you have a major U.S. naval base in Bahrain. And the economy of Bahrain pretty much operates to cater towards this naval base. influence and interference of the Saudis within Bahrain is pretty much absolute. And they have appropriated internal policy in Bahrain pretty much since the uprising began in 2011. And it continues to this day. So this latest action is definitely coming. It definitely has a Saudi angle. Because there was a point up to 6 months ago where there was sort of some signals from the Bahraini government that they wanted to diffuse things a little bit, but then all of a sudden we had another escalation happen where they're doing these sorts of things. And that says that the Bahraini government is essentially a puppet of the Saudis.
Right. And the Fifth Fleet, the U.S. Fifth Fleet, that's where it's anchored, is in Bahrain.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about other regional developments. There have been a series of meetings in recent days between top-level officials from Iran, Russia, and Syria. In the case of Russia, it was the defense minister came to Syria. At the same time, there's been military offensives against ISIS, and presumably those will grow both in Aleppo and in Raqqa. Talk about what this indicates in terms of the Syrian civil war. How do the Saudis view it? You have, again, the Obama administration is under pressure from within the U.S. State Department. 51 State Department officers used an internal channel to protest against Obama's policy, meaning that he wasn't hawkish enough, not openly attacking the Assad government, playing sort of attacking the Assad government politically, but militarily not carrying out strikes against the Syrian Arab Army. At the same time, you have the effort by the Obama administration, it seems, in some ways, to find some sort of solution or resolution to the war in Syria. Is that just a facade? Is it smoke and mirrors?
There's several different smoke and mirrors, and the Americans are not the only parties responsible for the smoke and mirrors in the Syrian theater at the moment. You know, there is some concern, for example, since this is, Russian station, there is some concern developing within Iran about some of the positions, for example, that Russia itself has taken on Syria, at least verbally on the diplomatic level regarding the federalization of Syria. For Iran, for example, these are red lines. And so there appears to be a divergence, at least on these levels, with Russia about how to diffuse this conflict. But as far as the Obama administration is concerned, anything they say cannot be really believed, given the fact that they're also then deploying through their EU lackeys on the ground, whether with weaponry or intelligence officers or what have you. So this conflict continues. And this is one of the reasons why the Syrian Arab army has sort of stopped from moving and retaking the whole of northern Syria yet, when they had a major offensive up to a few weeks ago that would have essentially crippled the back of these Takfiri armies completely.
So, in other words, what you're saying, Wahid, is that the offensive of the Syrian Arab army has been restrained or stopped as a consequence of pressure being applied on Syria by its international allies, and in particular, perhaps Russia.
It appears this way, and this is some of the thinking that is actually happening in Tehran. Yes.
And do you see manifestations of this in the Iranian media, where there's talk about the possible differences? I mean, Iran and Russia and the Syrian government are in a de facto military alliance, but that doesn't mean that there can't be differences between them. Is it being talked about openly in Iran?
Yeah, a lot of the news programs, talkback programs on Iranian state television are talking about this. It's not being discussed in terms of an outright rift. We're not there yet. It's just different views about this. And the issue of federalizing Syria is a red line. And it's a red line for Iran, and it's also a red line for the Hezbollah as well. They do not agree.
Federalizing, we have about a minute left. Just to help the audience understand, by federalizing, it's, in other words, the partitioning or soft partitioning of Syria. Just talk about it.
Well, on the issue of Kurdistan, Russia has sort of recently been advocating a position that has been articulated from Tel Aviv, strangely enough, and regarding giving independence, some form of autonomy to the Kurds. And this is a non-starter for Iran and Hezbollah, because this is essentially means that the sovereignty of Syria will inevitably be compromised. It's also, proposing a constitution where the central power of Damascus will be basically whittled down in light of this partition. And people don't agree with that on the ground.
in Iran, there have been military clashes also with Kurdish guerrillas who are seem to be affiliated with an organization that is linked to the PKK in Turkey. Is Iran also worried that federalizing Syria could lead to a precedent? Because, of course, Iran, like Turkey, like Syria, like Iraq, also has a Kurdish region.
That there's a concern there. There's also a concern for Iraq itself. And obviously, the Turks are petrified at that possibility themselves. Yes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Berlin by Wahid Azal. He is an independent political commentator based in Berlin. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump has yet again made controversial comments advocating religious, racial, and ethnic profiling. We are joined by Robert McCaw. He is the government affairs manager at the Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE. And we are also joined by Ted Rall. He is an author and editorial cartoonist. Welcome both Robert and Ted.
Thank you for having me.
Robert, let's start with you. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is the largest Islamic Muslim advocacy group in the United States. Undoubtedly, your members and millions of Muslims who live in the United States have to be alarmed as Donald Trump, now the Republican candidate or presumptive candidate, has come out once again advocating religious and racial profiling as a means of combating terrorism. What did he say? What's your reaction to it?
Well, over the weekend, Trump came out and he said that he thought it would be a good idea to profile religiously, ethnically Muslims in America. He said this in a response to the Orlando shooting, but this is just one of his many demonstrable statements that promote anti-Muslim bigotry and really would lead to profiling of all ethnic minorities in this country. CARE believes that profiling does not work. It distracts police resources at law enforcement resources as they are looking at individuals on the basis of their outward appearance or beliefs, and distracts from real law enforcement efforts to track down and prevent crime. Again, CARE opposes racial and religious profiling, not for Muslims, but for all Americans. It just leads us to a less safe place.
Okay, Robert, I want to have a follow-up question with you before we open it up to Ted Rall. I mean, in a way, there's already religious, racial, and ethnic profiling in the United States. I mean, mosques all over the country are being, you know, surveilled against. The government is sending individuals in who are acting as informants. I mean, there's already profiling.
Yes, there is profiling. And if you look at the Department of Justice's guidelines on racial profiling, religious profiling, while the guideline generally prohibits profiling, it makes an exception in cases of national security. It also permits the FBI to racially and ethnically map neighborhoods, which they do not only in the case of Muslim Americans, but all Americans. And yes, we do see informants placed in mosques, agent provocateurs that seek to solicit and trap Muslim youth into fabricated and scripted acts of terrorism. Many times these agent provocateurs are going after young and mentally disturbed youth that would need more help than being led down a wrong and false path. But yes, profiling does occur, but there's some limits to it. I think under a Trump administration, we would see less restrictions on this type of profiling as it is occurring. I'd hate to see what that looks like if we're already opposed to profiling as a nation.
Ted Rall, we heard from Robert McCaw from CARE talking about the fact that the government already does religious and racial profiling, but under Trump, it could be a lot worse, a lot scarier. Of course, the Muslim community already feels besieged any time there's any kind of a hate crime or terrorist act like what happened in Orlando. I mean, does Trump, you're writing a book about Trump, does he constitute a threat of fascism or semi-fascism?
I think he represents a clear threat of authoritarianism that goes beyond what we've already seen in the post 9/11 era. He plays very fast and loose with the facts, and even faster and looser with his willingness to use and deploy tactics that, aside from the fact that they probably have very little utility in terms of preventing or reducing or mitigating the risk of terrorism, are obviously completely anti-American and counter to what most people consider to be emblematic of a free or democratic society. He's not a guy who has read a lot of books on this. He hasn't, this Mussolini for Dummies is not on his bookshelf. He's instinctual. He's been playing to the crowds ever since the beginning of his campaign, really dating back at least to the birther controversy in 2009, 2010, 2011. And he finds that as he plays to the crowd, sort of like the Andy Griffith character in A Face in the Crowd, a great old movie about a demagogue, he finds that this works with a certain percentage of the population. It always has. It always will. And we need politicians who resist the urge to play to these people.
Robert McCaw, after Orlando, I mean, there has been a wave, both attacks against the Muslim community and also acts of solidarity between the Muslim community and the LGBT community, something that maybe is without historic precedent. You're doing action alerts in your office as we speak because of what the politicians, not just Donald Trump, are doing to take advantage of this to demonize Muslims.
Yes. Over the weekend, Representative Mo Brooks from Alabama with the Republican Party said that while Muslims have been out there condemning this shooting, this attack, that if they had the chance, they would kill every homosexual in America. Those were his words. CARE has, in his chapters, have issued over 17 statements condemning the shootings. They've held over a dozen rallies in solidarity with the LGBTIA community. We've helped raise over $70,000 in GoFundMe for the victims' families. And I think that as two communities, we're standing shoulder to shoulder as we confront together hate crimes, bigotry, and marginalization and discrimination of our communities. I think that we have a lot in common. But you see politicians like Representative Mo Brooks and also Donald Trump trying to use the Orlando shooting to create a wedge between the Muslim community and the LGBTIA community, and also between our communities and the American community. But really, we're not buying it. It's not going to happen.
Ted Rall, Donald Trump said that the United States should use Israel as the model for a religious and racial or ethnic profiling model. What did he mean by that? Why did he pick Israel? What's the reality of racial profiling or religious profiling in Israel?
Well, if you've flown out of Tel Aviv airport, as I have several times, and in, actually, profiling occurs. And frankly, you know, each time I've gone through this, I've kind of wondered whether it really even works. They look at things like the passport stamps in your passport, your visa stamps. In my case, I have some interesting ones from Afghanistan and other Muslim countries. So those attract attention from the Mossad agents that stop you at the airport. And then also they ask you for your receipts on the way out, and they ask you if you have any Muslim friends, if you've visited the occupied territories in Gaza or West Bank and so on. You know, if you really were intending to do something on a plane, you probably would have the correct answers to these questions. So I don't really know that they're effective. Never mind. Certainly, I think most Israelis would agree that they're not exactly living in a peaceful society. Whatever good this is doing seems to be escaping me. Israel certainly doesn't feel like the safest country in the world. So I don't know that I want to live in a country full of checkpoints and with racial profiling and ridiculous questions being asked all the time. What's never being asked is, what is the real root of these terrorist attacks? And, you know, it's American foreign policy, first and foremost. And then it's obviously there are a host of other issues, such as access to weapons and, of course, mental illness and the refusal of this country to take mental illness seriously or to provide to care for people who need it, to criminalize mental illness and so on. But what's really frustrating about events like Orlando is the fact that the big issues just sort of never seem to get talked about.
Yeah, Robert McCaw, Omar Mateen, the killer in Orlando, he said at the end he called the police and pledged allegiance to ISIS. But earlier he had pledged allegiance to Hezbollah, which is, of course, an enemy of ISIS. In other words, it doesn't really look like, and the police are now saying that there was no connection really to a foreign terrorist. What motivated Omar Mateen, we don't know really, but we know he was a deranged person. We know he suffered from a lot of mental illness. We also know that he targeted a gay community center. If you're ISIS and trying to overthrow the U.S. government or deal blows against the U.S. government, you're actually not probably going to go to an LGBT club on Latin night. It just is a very unlikely thing. He's filled with hatred. But the Muslim community is being targeted by Trump and these other demagogues, and it must create a certain real fear in the community. Talk about what the mood is right now.
There's definitely apprehension in the American community about not only Trump, but the threat of violence, the threat of hate speech, the acts of intimidation. Since the Orlando shooting, we've seen a spike, over 15 to 20 acts of anti-Muslim harassment and violence. Just in the past week. It's something we'll be documenting shortly. There is a real threat to the Muslim community following attacks like this, but when you look at it, there were over 350 mass shootings last year. There was, I think so far, over 100 mass shootings this year. Hundreds and hundreds of countless lives have been taken by gun violence in this country by individuals, when you take religion out of it, that similarly fit the profile of Omar Mateen. Young, mentally unstable, and access to weapons. We do not see talk show media and radio pundits going after the vast majority of mass shooters who are white or Christian, but we see the singling out of Omar Mateen. And again, we now see the singling out of the American Muslim community. The only thing that CARE can do as a national civil rights organization, we're stressing to the Muslim community to go over the safety materials that our and other organizations have provided for mosque safety, community safety, essentially fortify their mosque, make sure that they have security in place, that they know what to do during an active shooter scenario, and also to, on the other side of the coin, to get civically engaged, to know what their rights are, to report hate crimes, and by God, this election, get the Muslim souls to the polls and get out and vote.
Ted Rall, Donald Trump himself says it was the attack in Paris, the terrorist attack that ISIS claimed credit for, terrible attack, more than 100 people gunned down while they were at clubs and other social scenes, cafes. And then the San Bernardino killing, where two individuals connected themselves, pledged allegiance to ISIS. Donald Trump says that's when his campaign really, really took off. But what Robert's saying is that there's a mass shooting in the United States 350 times a year, I think he said. That's almost one per day. And yet you have a situation where somebody who, even like Omar Mateen, may be on a terrorism watch list, or people with extreme mental illness, they can go in and with almost out inhibition buy automatic weapons like the AR-15 that I think in the 9-second time period he was able to fire 30 rounds off. When it comes to fighting terrorism, it sort of stops at the doorstep of how you can access automatic weaponry, because those are the weapons that the NRA wants to promote.
Yeah, well, it's hard to understand, really. I'm very in favor of the Second Amendment, but I'm kind of curious about the whole rationale of the whole assault weapons ban, or the opposition to it, since it expired back during the Bush years. A lot of military weapons are not legal. You can't buy hand grenades. I would love to have my own RPG. I can't get one. So assault weapons have no purpose except for shooting human beings. I mean, I guess you could say that about handguns too. But assault weapons are meant to kill large number of human beings in a very short period of time, as you pointed out. There's no hunting application. The only justification I've ever read is I enjoy target practicing with them. Well, I'm sure you could enjoy target practice with an RPG too, but those are military weapons. They're not considered to have any application for civilian use. So these debates are just they're not focusing on a main point here. And I think that what I'm a little frustrated by is the reluctance of the right to even confront what I just said, even among people like me who are in favor of gun rights. And then I guess on the left, there's the refusal to accept the idea that, you know, we need to, that there is a Second Amendment and that people who have guns have legitimate fears of particularly government oppression. So again, we're just not having the conversation that we really need to have. And in terms of the constant shootings, let's face it, when Omar Nateen's name was released, you know, on the radio, I was driving and I turned to the person next to me and I was like, oh God, because I just knew what would follow: more nativism, more bigotry, more anti-Muslim BS. And it keeps us from focusing on the issue, which is way too many people have mental problems. Way too many people have easy access to guns. And even this issue of this latest proposal, which is to try to prevent people on the no-fly list from obtaining access to weapons, to me isn't a very good answer, because the no-fly list is a mess. All sorts of people are on that thing, like Ted Kennedy was on it, that shouldn't have been on it. So I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of the government being able to restrict people's Second Amendment rights purely, just arbitrarily, without any kind of recourse or oversight or transparency, which is what the no-fly list is right now. So we're still sorting out the mess from 9/11.
There's a lot to talk about on it. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Of course, Robert McCaw, as Ted Rall mentioned, people even on the no-fly list, thousands of people, and your organization has filed lawsuits because many of them are just babies and children, and they're just there because of they're there because they have Muslim sounding names, a lot of them. That's very, very true, the point that he made. We are out of time. We've been talking with Robert McCaw. He's the government affairs manager of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the largest Muslim advocacy group in the United States, and by Ted Rall, author and editorial cartoonist. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The referendum in Britain on whether to leave or remain inside the European Union is just 2 days away. Has the murder of a Labour MP by a far-right gunman last week boosted the chances of Britain remaining in the EU, or will the Leave campaign pull off a victory? We are joined from London by Eddie Dempsey. He is on the executive of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, or RMT, and a supporter of the Lexit campaign, Leaving the EU from the Left. Welcome, Eddie Dempsey.
Hi, thanks.
Okay, let's start with the murder of Joe Cox. Of course, we have an international audience, but a U.S. audience. Joe Cox was brutally murdered. She was the first parliamentarian killed since 1990. Talk about that case and what its impact is on the referendum, if any.
Yeah, well, first of all, the murder of Joe was clearly an act of far-right terrorism, and the individual who carried out that attack was somebody with deeply held neo-Nazi beliefs, who'd been involved in various different far-right organisations in Britain. The attack on Joe, her brutal murder, no doubt, I'm sure at least, will have an effect on the referendum. And in some cases, people are making or insinuating links between this guy's terrible attack and the EU referendum. Joe herself was a Labour MP and a supporter of the Remain campaign. But the far right has been growing across the European Union for a long time. There's always been far right organisations in existence. This attack in itself, I don't think, was motivated by the European Union referendum, but it's pretty clear, looking at some of the polling since the murder took place, that in some people's minds, this will have an effect. And I think that has shown itself, especially in the telephone polls. We've seen a 7-point swing in some of the telephone polls towards Remain. But it's a little bit difficult to really pinpoint it down to that attack, because generally in referendums like this, as you approach the voting date, what tends to happen is people generally do swing towards the status quo in a lot of these cases. So yeah, it has been a dreadful attack, and it's a terrible thing that took place. And I'm sure that in some cases this will have an effect on people's decision around the European Union, because a lot of the debate around the referendum question has been really fueled by racist arguments and really talking about the divisions between people and making the referendum a debate in some cases around the question of immigration, which is really not what the debate's about at all.
So the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, the new progressive left-wing leadership that surprisingly took the leadership of the Labour Party, the official position is to remain inside the EU. I think the argument is that the advocates for Brexit, for Britain leaving the EU, that's motivated by a right-wing position in the main. But you represent a section of the left, and you're calling yourself the Lexit campaign to distinguish yourself from the Brexit campaign, meaning you're against Britain's continued participation inside the EU for left-wing reasons. You are not anti-immigrant. You are not xenophobic. You, in fact, are promoting solidarity between different peoples and workers in different countries. But it's an odd constellation, because you have the Brexit campaign that has the Farage's party, the right-wing party, the xenophobes campaigning, and a smaller minority of leftists who are in the same camp. So help the audience understand the difference between Lexit and, say, the mainstream or more right-wing dominated Brexit campaign, if you call it that. I don't know. You characterize it if you would. Talk about the differences.
Okay, sure. Well, it does get pretty complicated, but probably the best way to put it, there are various campaigns in Britain from what we'd call a left perspective who are campaigning and have been for many years against the European Union and for Britain's exit from it. Some of those groups have got a campaign called Lexit, and they're using that to make the left-wing case to leave the European Union. There's other organisations that are formed purely of trade unions, which are making a trade unionist argument against the European Union. But essentially, what it boils down to is that this is a democratic question. And so the principle of sovereign national democracy isn't really the sole property, if you want, of the left. You can push the question of democracy from people across various different political spectrums. So what we have is a real split across the political spectrum in Britain on this question. But if you really want to boil it down and to have a look at what's really going on underneath a lot of the rhetoric, you can see that the largest part of transnational capital, so the big banks, the financial institutions, the government, the European Union, the IMF, all of these people are in favour of a Remain vote in the European Union. And the people who are generally voting in Britain for Remain tend to be people who are more upwardly mobile. They're from sort of the middle class, well-educated sections of society. And the people who are campaigning, or should I say, more likely to vote for a Leave, are working class people and people at the bottom of the labour market, because these are the people who more keenly feel the effects of EU membership on their day-to-day lives. Now, we have a position on the European Union and have had a position on the European Union for many years. Originally in Britain, the entire labour movement, all of the trade unions and all of the left-wing parties, bar maybe one or two, were all in opposition to the European Union. And what changed was in 1988, Jacques Delors, the European president, came to our TUC, Trade Union Congress, and gave a speech to Congress at a time when the British trade unions were in a period of suffering real defeat. We just had the miners' strike defeated by the Thatcher government. Anti-trade union legislation was being imposed on us. And he promised the delegates at that conference that the European Union was going to have this thing called Social Europe. We'd have full employment. We're going to have workers' rights given to us. He told us the class war was finished and that the European Union was going to tame the Tory party. But we've seen now that a lot of the trade unions fell for that position. And it came at a time when the Labour Party moved to the right under Blair. the right wing of the Labour Party has always been strongly in favour of the European Union, and the traditional democratic left of the Labour Party, people like Tony Benn, and up until the point just before he was elected Labour leader, also Jeremy Corbyn, were always opposed to the European Union. My union, the RMT, never changed this position, and every year our members democratically take a vote on what our national policy should be in all kinds of areas, and every single year they ratify their decision to campaign for an exit from the European Union on the basis that it's anti-democratic. There isn't anybody in the European Parliament that we can elect who has the power to propose legislation. And funny enough, I was just looking at a series of debates that took part in the English Civil War back in the 1600s. And the debates then, so-called the Putney debates between the anti-royalist forces, some of the people even then were saying that nobody should have to live under a government if they don't have a say in who is making the laws that we have to live under. But on that principle, the European Union is undemocratic and we don't support it. The other principle we campaign on is that we believe in public ownership of our services and of our industry. The European Union treaties and legislation specifically makes many areas of many industries and many public services, it takes it out of our ability to take those back into public ownership. It makes, in effect, socialism illegal. So our railways, we want to have nationalised. And Corbyn, he says that he wants to nationalise railways. But under the EU fourth rail package, which is due to come into effect in December 2019, all European member states will be compelled to offer up all of their passenger train services to competitive private tendering, in effect privatisation. And this piece of legislation is mandatory. Now, this isn't something anybody in Europe has asked for. No citizens have asked for this. And this demonstrates how law is made in the European Union. So corporations, in conjunction with the European Commission, which is unelected, via their working groups, formulate legislation. And that's then passed down to the European Parliament, which is the only institution European citizens can directly elect people to. And they don't have the power to propose any legislation of their own. They can either only amend it or reject it or accept it. That's it.
We're talking with Eddie Dempsey. He is on the executive of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, RMT. He's a supporter of the Lexit campaign, meaning Britain should leave, UK should leave the EU, but distinguished from the Brexit campaign, which is dominated by more conservative or even right-wing parties. We've been talking about the impact that the brutal murder of British parliamentarian, Labour Party parliamentarian Jo Cox, what impact her murder might have on the referendum that will take place in 2 days. Eddie Dempsey, I want to read to you a report that just came out from the Insider Business Times, obviously a corporate and bank interested publication. It says global stock markets surged Monday as polls over the weekend showed an increased possibility of Britain remaining in the EU. This is after the brutal murder of Jo Cox. Uncertainty over the vote this week had led investors to shift away from oil and stocks last week to safe haven investments such as the yen and gold. Now, we know Obama came to the UK. He inserted himself in this debate within the UK and said Britain will go to the back of the queue in terms of U.S.-British trade relations if the British left the EU. Obviously, the American government, representing, I would say, the interests of Wall Street and major corporations, wants the Brits to stay in. Donald Trump, who represents an outlier but still very right-wing position inside the U.S. political establishment, now has just announced that he favors Britain leaving the U.K. I don't think people in the U.K. care about what Donald Trump actually thinks. But it is interesting that the stock markets are surging because the polls seem to be swinging back. The corporate stock market, corporate-dominated stock market, surging back because it looks like popular opinion has shifted at least somewhat after the murder.
Well, I'm not surprised in the slightest because the European Union is an institution of multinational corporations and the big financial institutions. The Single European Act which really set in stone the neoliberal free market as the, you know, the only way we do things in the European Union, was drawn up by the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which is an invitation-only group of the CEOs of the biggest multinational corporations who've got headquarters in European member states. And so they have a stake in this. It's their institution. They use it to subvert national democracy and to impose austerity everywhere and to make sure they've got access to markets and they've got and make sure that they're able to have as much of our public services and industries in European member states in private hands. So it's no surprise that the markets have rallied because all of the multinational corporations, they've all got a stake in this. This is their institution and they don't want to see it broken.
Eddie Dempsey, I want to ask you in the last 4 minutes that we have, time goes so fast, unfortunately, I want to ask you about how the issue of immigration plays out on the ground for working class folks in the UK. Of course, a lot of immigration now is coming into UK from Eastern Europe. There's two issues here. One is racism and xenophobia, nationalism. In other words, kind of a reactionary hostility to immigrants. But are there other real problems that are don't reduce themselves just to the issue of xenophobia or racism with the influx of immigrants, given the status of working class people in Britain? Is there a progressive way that you're trying to handle the issue of immigration? And just talk about how it plays out amongst your membership, for instance.
Well, we have to make the distinction, first of all, between immigration and the free movement of labor, which is part of the Single European Act enshrined in the Lisbon Treaty, part of the fourth and fundamental principles of a neoliberal free market, free movement of capital, services, goods and labour. Immigration is something quite different. In relation to the EU, what we're actually not talking about is immigration. The free movement of labour was set up in order to create a 500 million strong labour market in order for corporations to better exploit workers around Europe. And they use the free movement of labour to drive workers across national borders in order to drive down wages, terms and conditions. And that has an effect because people do frame this problem in terms of right-wing rhetoric. People do frame it in terms of immigration and all of the rest of it. But you see, if you're a working-class person who's on minimum wage in the construction industry where there isn't much job security, You're put directly in competition, not just with the unemployed people in your own country, but with everybody across the entire European Union. And the effect that has been, in some cases, for wages to be depressed. And the politicians are quite explicit about this. John Reid, the former Labour minister, when he was interviewed on the Andrew Marr show a year or two ago, he said Labour's policy under Blair then was to support free movement of labour for all of the new accession countries that were just coming into the European Union on the basis they implemented wage discipline.
Those are the East European and Central European countries, the former socialist bloc countries.
Now, of course, as trade unionists, we take a position that we don't care where you come from in the world. We don't care where you're from. We don't care what the colour of your skin is. If you come to Britain, you're a worker. You could be a member of our union. And you're our brother or you're our sister, and we'll struggle together to improve wages and conditions for everybody. But we've got to differentiate between immigration, which is one thing, and the free movement of labour, which is something quite separate. So in some of the